Celine Patricia Maloney, and my place of birth is Valentia Island, County Kerry, Ireland.
Perfect.
Okay. Is that okay for sound?
It's good.
And we can stop any time.
Yeah, we can. Okay. We can pause at any time. So just for the record, this is Bernadette Sweeney here in Butte. On Friday the 4th of March, I'm here interviewing Celine Maloney in her beautiful home. And with us is videographer Patrick Cook. Are you good to go, Patrick?
How should I sit now, Bernadette?
Whatever is most comfortable for you.
I'm nervous a bit, I suppose.
Or don't be, we'll just
okay.
Chat.
Okay.
And as I say, we can always edit out or pause at any time.
Okay, sounds
yeah.
Great.
So tell me a little bit about Valentia Island to start with. You were born and grew up in Valentia?
I was born in Valentia in our own house at home at the cable station, number 15 cable station upstairs. Dr. McKenna delivered me, which was probably somewhat unusual because there wasn't many doctors around South Kerry at the time. But my father worked for the cable station, for the Transatlantic Cable Company. It was owned by Western Union. And one of the benefits of the people that worked for the cable station was they had a doctor on call for all labour and deliveries, for all sore toes, sick heads and anything in between. And so we had the luxury of having Dr. McKenna at my birth.
Okay.
And I was born in the middle of a mad gale in November, gale force 9 or 10. And it was a kind of a wild night, but an exciting night, I'm sure, at home when I came out.
And how? Tell me your parents' names.
My father is Des Lavelle, and my mother's name was Patricia. O'Neill was her maiden name. She was from Carsevine. Her father was a fish exporter, and my father was a cable stationer, as they were known as, because he was born and raised in the cable station. And he worked for the electric generating station on the cable. So the cable came to Valentia in 1880, and then they had the cable station and the homes. It was like a development for 23 families, and they had a big office for all the workers. And my father worked there as an electrician, really, for the power plant.
Yeah.
And so there was power on Valentia Island at this little development in 1880.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no power anywhere in Ireland at that time, as you can imagine. The electrification of rural Ireland actually happened in the late 1950s. And I remember talking to Mrs. Curran, she's a woman back the road from us at home. And I said, what was it like, you know, with all those kids, Mrs. Curran? Oh, she said, a fella came up the road to me in 1959 and he says, Mrs., will you take the light? And I said to him, I prefer the water, because she had no water in her house.
Mm-hmm.
And at that stage, she had 3 or 4 kids by 1959. I think there was 12 Currans altogether growing up. But she, of course, would prefer the water. It would have been much better for her than the light. But the electricity came, like, officially to Valentia in December 1959. But the cable station had it since the 1880s.
Mm-hmm.
And all the houses had electric light, of course, and power. Although there weren't really any, you know, washers or dryer or microwaves or anything then, because they hadn't been invented. But they all had staff, girls to light the fires for them and make the, they had cooks and everything.
Yeah.
It was a kind of a special enclave.
Yeah. Tell us, for the anybody who might be listening to the tape who's not familiar with Valentia, tell us a little bit about the island.
Oh, the island is small, about 12 square miles only,
yeah.
And it's off the coast of South Kerry. Geographically an island until 1969 when they built the bridge.
Yeah.
We had a bridge then to connect us to the mainland. And I remember the bridge being built. It was a big, long process. We had P.J. Hagerty's construction company from Cork come to build it. And they kind of dawdled towards the end. And that was in 69. There was student riots in Paris at the time. And they went wild in Paris. And we took it upon ourselves. Well, I was only a child at the time. But we went and stormed the barricades, the whole island stormed the barricades and went across the bridge and climbed over and snuck through and all kinds of things in a peaceful protest to say, let's get this bridge going, let's get this party started. And after that, then they quickly opened it up for us.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's kind of exciting at the time, you know.
A little rebel,
yeah.
How far is Valentia from the mainland?
It's actually about a mile at the longest part and about a quarter of a mile. The bridge is only a quarter of a mile long, so that's the narrowest section at the Port McGee section.
And so what, did you go to school on the island?
I went to school at the National School up the fields, across the fields in my Wellington boots to Master Griffin. And it was that National School had just two classrooms. So Maura Moran was the lady teacher for the first four grades, and then Master Griffin did the other four.
Yeah.
And we had a big old turf fire in the winter in the school. No running water in the toilets, which was interesting to me because, of course, we had come from a house with running water.
Yeah.
And my father had a big fight with the bishop in the late 1960s, saying, you know, it's time to get some running water at that school. And Bishop Eamon Casey was all against it because, of course, the church at that time really controlled all the schools, the national schools, and actually the secondary schools in Ireland as well. But between the jigs and the reels, they managed to persuade him and subsequently put in toilets of running water.
Eamon Casey was against putting running water.
He was very against it at the time, yes. And
was it the expense?
Of course.
Yeah.
What else? Because if it went into Valencia, it would have to go to all the other schools in South Kerry and in Kerry, which his whole diocese.
Yeah.
I'm sure. Why else would it be? I mean, can you think of any other reason
no,
why they couldn't have it?
Really. Peculiar.
It seems so peculiar, yes.
Yeah.
And so there was a big thing about money as well. He said he was going to pay for it. And my father pulled out a cheque for £50 at the time. And he said, this is the start of the fund. And there was no going back then. Yeah.
So did your dad work as a cable?
He was an electrician in the power plant.
Right.
For the electricity for the cable station.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so the bad thing was that his the cable, because of satellites and all that,
uh-huh.
the cable company closed down in 1965. And so they knew from about 63 that this was coming. And so when the cable closed down and Western Union left that development, most people went on to work in London at the London office or, you know, took redundancy packages, or some went to the Azores. There was also a station out in the Azores in the Atlantic there.
Yeah.
And my father didn't want to go.
Yeah.
He was too much in love with Valencia and South Kerry and all that.
Yeah.
And so he said to my mother, why don't we start a scuba diving center? And of course, in 1965, in Ireland, in Europe, there was no such thing really as a scuba diving center as anywhere. Probably there were some maybe off the south coast of England, but there was nothing in Ireland then. And she said, of course, that sounds like a great idea.
Yeah.
And that's they stayed on and they started their scuba diving business, and they purchased their house, which they had previously just rented from Western Union. They purchased their house. And my mother ran the bed and breakfast part.
Yeah.
And my father ran the boat part. And they had that business all through their married lives.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it was a little different, for
yeah.
sure. So they worked during the summer very hard, you know, all the time.
Yeah.
And then in the winter, they didn't have any income, really.
Yeah.
Except one year, Daddy did go to Dingle. The whole family, in fact, moved to Dingle to work on Ryan's Daughter when the movie was made in Dingle.
Mm-hmm.
He went to do special effects and wind and be a boat consultant and ocean consultant for them, for MGM.
My goodness. Remind me, what year was Ryan's Daughter?
It was around 1969, 1970, around that time. It took
mm-hmm.
quite a long time in production because they also had to move to Clare, and they worked out of the Bridges of Ross in Clare, your own county.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we lived in Kilkee, actually, for 6 months around that time, because we were on location there.
Oh, my goodness. So you all went?
We all went, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how many children did your parents have?
Oh, my I have
one sister.
Linda. She lives in San Francisco. Linda Lavelle.
My goodness. So.
And she's younger than me. She came out to America after I came out.
Yeah. Well, we're there. Let's move on to that topic. Tell us how you came to America. How did that come back?
Well, I really had no intention of ever coming to America, to be quite honest. You know, growing up, America was like someplace over there, you know, never took too much notice about it. We didn't really, we had distant relatives there out in Napa Valley, but nobody really close. And other people, you know, in my class at school would be getting legacies and boxes from America with all kinds of fabulous clothes in and things like that. But I just didn't have too much context, so it never really came into my head. But then one day when I was in Dublin, when I graduated from high school, I went to Dublin for school and that for college.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was there, I was walking up over Portobello Bridge, and there was a secondhand record store just there after the side. So I used to always go in and look, see what kind of music they had. And the day I went in, I heard this music, and I thought, what is that? I've never heard anything as exciting sounding as it before. And it was the Born to Run album by Bruce Springsteen.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, that is so great. Where did he come from? How come I haven't heard about him before? And so then I, you know, found out a bit about it, that he was American and all that. I thought that was kind of the start of my seed of there must be something good over there, you know. And so it kind of got me thinking a little bit about it.
Yeah.
And then I worked in West Cork for a year after I graduated from the pharmacy school program. And I had a great time in West Cork. It was a great place for great fun down in Skull, down around Ballydehob and Skull and that. But I just thought, well, maybe I'll give that America a shot.
Mm.
And so I saved up my money and bought the ticket from TWA. I think they're gone now.
There, yeah.
For £500 it cost, I remember. Mm. And then I also had £500 for spending. No Visa, no Amex, no anything else, no MasterCard. And I said, I'm heading off.
Yeah. What age were you?
I was 24, I think.
No.
Can't really remember. I think I was about 24.
So after school, you left. Did you go to high school in Valencia?
I went to, no, we didn't have a high school there. We had to take the bus to town.
Right.
The school bus picked me up at the gate at 8:15 in the morning, and I went up to the nuns at the Presentation Convent in Carsevine.
Yeah.
And I was there for 5 years. It was a fun school and a great time.
And then you went to...
And then I went to university in Dublin.
UCD?
I went to UCD for a couple of years, and then I stepped out of the UCD program and went into a pharmacy training program through the School of Pharmacy, which was actually linked into Trinity College. And it was a kind of a hands-on training technician type program for an assistant pharmacist.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that. I worked in Camden Street, 36 Lower Camden Street with Dermot Cahill for 4 or 5 years, and then went on to the pharmacy school for about a year of didactic work.
Mm-hmm.
And then I graduated with my assistant's license.
Very good. And then off to West Cork.
Off to West Cork for a year, yeah. Mm-hmm. For great fun.
And then you went on your holiday to the States.
And then I went to my holiday to the States. That was my plan, to go for about 6 months and see what it was like, you know.
Yeah. So where did you go to?
Well, the funny thing is, when I landed in New York, and I didn't really have too much of a contact. I was going to go to San Francisco. I didn't really know where I would go.
Mm.
And I thought, well, I'll have to go someplace that's near the oceans, because I'm from an island and I'll have to get someplace near the water. So I thought, well, then Boston, that sounds good because it's very Irish.
Mm.
And then San Francisco, that sounds nice as well, or Los Angeles. But when I narrowed it down, I came in the winter time and someone said, gosh, it'll be all snowy and cold in Boston. I said, oh, I couldn't stand that. Then I ended up in Montana. So I said, well, it has to be like someplace warmer. And so I went with the choice of San Francisco or Los Angeles. But Los Angeles just sounded too big.
Mm.
You know, it's like just too spread out. And I said, well, San Francisco, that sounds nice. And so I picked that.
And did you know anybody there?
I didn't really know anybody, to be quite honest. But I had met somebody again the summer before. Oh, I was hitching a lift from Killarney, and this fella, he was an American, and he was going around on his tour, and I said, I'm going to go to San Francisco, I have it in my mind. Oh, he said, you'll get a job. I said, I've no work, where'll I get a job? And he said, oh, you'll get a job at Henry Africa's. I know that it's a fern bar. They were very popular in the 80s. And he said, go down there and look for Norman Hobday. He owns that place. You'll easily get a job. Oh, I said, that's great. And so anyway, I wrote it down in my book. And then... I didn't really have any place to stay or anything. That was a bit of a problem for me. And you see, I had a limited budget because I only had $500.
Yeah.
And so another night when I was in West Cork, out in, out there, you know, that's it, back by Goline. Barley Cove, that's the name of the place. I was back in Barley Cove and I met a few lads from Kilcrohan or something like that. And they were living in San Francisco. Excuse me. And they said to me, we live in San Francisco. I said, I'm going to go out there. Well, here's our number. Give us a call. Oh, I said, good enough. And so I didn't think any more about it, you know, because that was the summertime and I put the number in my book or something. But when I got out to New York, I was thinking, I better call that crowd in San Francisco on account of that there'll be, you know, someone to pick me up. Or I wasn't really quite sure where they lived. I had no address or anything. So I couldn't quite work the phones. That was a bit of a problem for me at JFK, because you had to have quarters. I probably had some dollars, maybe. I must have had $500 in cash, probably. But, you know, that was paper money.
Yeah.
And the thing, when I dialed the number in San Francisco, it said $5.50 or something. It was a lot of money, actually, for a call, wasn't it, when you think about it? And I had no quarters. And how was I going to ask somebody to give me five? I didn't, you know, couldn't figure that out. So then I thought, oh, I'll call Collect. You know, that's from the movies. I knew about that. And so I dialed again. I said, I'm calling Collect. And so, anyway, the operator said, they're not accepting any Collect charges. I said, oh, I'm really in a pickle now, you know, because what am I going to do? You see, I think it was somebody else picked up the phone. It wasn't the fella that I met. Maybe it was his brother or something like that. I said, so I called the operator up a third time. I said, say I'm from Ireland. And I'm calling collect anyway. So they picked up the phone anyway when I said I was from Ireland. And it was your man's brother. And he knew nothing about me, of course.
Yeah.
And I said, hey, I'm Céline Lavelle and I'm from Kerry and I'm going to be in San Francisco in 5 hours. I need somebody to pick me up. I have no place to stay or anything. I said, where's your man, your brother? I met your brother there 6 months ago. Oh, he said, it's Thanksgiving around here. He hasn't been seen for days. Well, I said, well, I'm coming and I know nobody, so somebody better pick me up. And so anyway, that was it. I'll see what I can do. Or think, what was the brother's name? Was he Paddy? I can't remember the brother's name now. Anyway, but Noel was the fellow that was supposed to pick me up. So anyway, I was a bit nervous then on the next leg of the journey coming across to San Francisco. But as luck would have it, when I got out and I pulled my bag and all that, I came out onto the sidewalk there, you know, where all the taxis are and all that. Your man was coming up, Noel Spillane and some other fellas, well. One of the Donovan brothers, I think, from Kilcrahan was with them as well. And they had a car and they said, oh, how are you doing? I said, I'm good. Pick me up. And that was it.
You were lucky.
I was very lucky. Yeah. Oh, luck of the Irish.
So tell us about your first impressions of America.
Well, we actually went into the Shannon Arms in San Francisco. So it was kind of a local haunt. It still is for all that crowd, I think. And it was around Thanksgiving and everyone was off from work and all that. And they were all just glad to see me. And what was going on at home? And did I have a job? And did I have any cousins? And I was traveling my own. I think they found that a bit strange that I was traveling my own, that I didn't have like traveling companions and all that. But I was thinking that I better get a job anyway and a place to stay. So I got a place to stay. There was a house being in the Sunset that was slated for demolishment. You know, they were going. There was a big old house there and it had a huge garden and they were going to build like a fourplex or something in it. And so there were people staying in that house for the guys that owned it until they got their planning permission or something like that. And so I stayed in that house. It was a lovely old house, actually, for a while. And then I was thinking I better get a job. And so I called your man up, Norman Hobdy. I found the number in the book. And I said, I met so-and-so. Whatever his name was anyway, the fellow that gave me the lift, he didn't know who he was or anything. I said, I'm from Ireland, I'm looking for a job. Oh, he said, how old are you? And he said, how tall are you? And then he said, what weight are you? And I said, God, I'm about 10 stone, I think. Stones, he says, what's that in pounds? I have no idea. And I converted it anyway, going, oh yeah, all right, okay. All right, so he said, come on down so on Monday and I'll interview. So that was like three funny questions, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And so I went down and he hired me and I went cocktailing at the Henry Africa's.
Oh, you're a cocktail waitress.
Mm-hmm. And it was great fun. We had a great time. It was a real popular spot. And the 49ers were playing great football at the time. I think they won the Super Bowl that year, actually. So it was kind of wild, you know, in all the bars and all that. And it was really great staff there. You know, people my own age. A kind of an unusual bunch. They were all terribly well educated, went to Cal and Brown and that kind of thing, but great kids, and they really welcomed me, and I was the only immigrant, you could say, working there. Really, they were all American born and everything else.
Yeah. So you're in San Francisco and you have $500 in your pocket and you're working as a cocktail waitress.
Yeah.
And here we are all these years later in Montana and you're still in America. So what happened?
Well, it just seemed to work for me. That first 6 months was fabulous. And but then my time was up, my visa was up and all that, so I had to go home. And I went home a little bit sad, but still happy because I had such a great time. And I came home for about, you know, 6 months or 8 months. And the money ran out, of course, after a while. And I was thinking, what am I going to do again? And America kind of beckoned me. And so I hit it off a second time. And this time I got a job. I decided I'd kind of legalize my status in a more permanent fashion. So I got a job actually working for a family as their nanny for a Jewish family in San Francisco. And then I started processing my papers. And so that's a kind of a tedious process. Getting your papers, you have to get an attorney and you have to advertise and fill out a bunch of forms, and it takes quite a few years, many years in fact. So Jim Byrne was an attorney who was a new grad out of law school in San Francisco, and he was doing a lot of work for immigrants at the time. And I went to see him, and he opened my file, and we started working on that. And I mean, it went on for, I say, 3 or 4 years at least, you know. And so, very tedious. And I was getting restless, you know. I had a fabulous job with the Gordon family. They were really, really good to me. And I was just kind of getting restless with the time level. And so, as luck would have it, there were Donnelly visa applications at the time. There were kind of a lotto visa. I'm sure you've heard about them.
Yeah.
I won a Donnelly visa.
Oh, you did.
And so then I could give up my visa process in the other fashion.
Yeah.
And I was, then I left the Gordons then and went on to get a real job, you might say, you know. Although that really was a fabulous job. It was a fun job. They were a great family and just great kids and all that. And we lived in a beautiful house up on Cherry Street, number one Cherry Street mansion.
Yeah.
I think there was about 10,000 square feet or something like that.
Yeah.
And they were very good to me. But I was ready kind of to move on to the next section.
So what was the immigrant Irish population in San Francisco like at that time?
It was thriving. I'd have to say that there was people coming all the time. Around the time, and they were all around my own age. A lot of people coming from the north of Ireland, a lot of people coming from, you know, the western seaboard, Kerry, Cork. Whole parishes came from West Cork, especially, you know, whole families and whole. I mean, there was just, I think, like 90% of the teenage population of Drimaleague had moved to San Francisco in the 1980s. And so we had a fantastic time. I must say, construction was booming. All the lads really worked in construction, and they were hard workers, you know, great partiers, but worked very hard as well, and were very successful with the construction companies. Quite a few of them had worked on the pipeline. They'd be a bit older than me now, maybe say 10 years older than me, and so they'd come out before me, and they came to America to work specifically on the Alaska pipeline. And when that was done, a good 10 or 20 of those guys moved down to San Francisco. So they had a good start. They had the money from the pipeline to start their companies, and they would give jobs then to people of my age that came out. And everybody kind of helped everybody else. And, you know, people were making great money and great successes. And it was so exciting to be a part of it all, really.
And did you socialize a lot with that group?
I had the friends from, I still kept my friends from the bar time, those, the kids that I met at Henry Africa's, and they were great. So I had a bit of both, really. I had my kind of American life during the day. This is now when I was the nanny life, you know.
Yeah.
I had my American life during the day with the family and that.
Mm.
And then in the evening time, I would be off out, whatever music was over from Ireland, or at the week, I never worked weekends. I'd be at football matches in Golden Gate Park and go to the races down at Golden Gate Fields, or out fishing out of Sausalito and places like that. And I was never really staying at home watching TV.
No. And did your sister come out to you?
My sister then won a visa as well. I was out maybe about 5 or 6 years when my sister won. I think she also won a Donnelly visa. Or would it have been a Morrison? I'm not exactly sure about that, because there were Morrison visas subsequently thereafter. And so she came out and she went working at the Westin St. Francis, downtown San Francisco. She was a graduate from the Shannon School of Hotel Management. And so she went working down there. And so we were in San Francisco together for about a year before I met my soon-to-be husband, who was from Montana. And then I left San Francisco and came up here.
Yeah. So your husband's name is?
My husband is Steve Maloney, and he's from Butte, Montana. And his grandfather came to America from Donegal in the 1890s, or around the turn of the century. His grandfather was born in Donegal in 1875. And so his father was American-born, but Butte was like the real Irish tradition. It was funny coming to Butte from San Francisco because, you know, it was such a small town. But yet it was so Irish, and just a funny transition, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
But Steve really, I had met Steve in San Francisco. I'd lived there about 7 years, and he really wanted to come back to Montana and really wanted to come back to Butte, you know, he couldn't find, there was no other town in Montana that was quite good enough. And so he said, will you come up and see what it's like? So I came up for a weekend, St. Patrick's Day weekend. Mm. Probably not the greatest time of the year to see Butte, really. You know, it's probably warmer in the summer. It was snowing like mad, you know. Yeah.
What year was that, Celine?
I can't remember. You know, probably around 1991 maybe or something like that. And he had a fabulous family, though. Whatever about the weather, you know, the buildings were kind of beat up. And, you know, San Francisco is so glorious in the sunshine always, and the seas there, and the bay, and the bridge. And it's just glamour cat city, you know. Yeah. And I came up here, and there's a pit, you know, and the uptown and the downtown. And I thought, And so his family, then I met his family, and he had three fabulous sisters and a fabulous brother, and then great aunt and uncle and fabulous cousins. And they were so nice. I said, well, you know, I'll have to give this a shot. Yeah. And so then we were back and forth from Ireland quite a bit because I was still going back to Ireland and helping my parents with their business because it was very busy in the summertime. And eventually, between the jigs and the reels, we were dating for about 3 years back and forth. He proposed.
And what year did you get married?
I'll have to think about that one as well. I think we got married in 94. It's been fun though.
And do you have children?
We have two lovely boys. We have a son, Sam. He's 14. And we have a second son called Jackson. He's 11. We just have a fun time with them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when you moved to Butte, what were your impressions of Butte once you were an actual inhabitant of the town?
Well, to be honest, Butte has just smiled on me since I've been here. Everything fantastic, you know. People that I know or that knew the family were so warm and welcoming to me. Just kind of treated me like royalty almost, you know. Yeah. It's fabulous. And then people that I didn't know treated me fabulously as well. You know, they would say to me a lot of the time, oh, you sound like my grandmother from Ireland, you know, or something like that. And it would kind of bring happy memories back to them, something I would say or the sound of my voice, you know, because so many of the Butte Irish did come from, well, West Cork, really, I suppose, was the highest percentage. But I mean, the accent from South Kerry and West Cork, it's almost the same, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you could imagine how they'd associate that with their grandparents or something like that. So, just a fabulous town, really. It's funny, you forget about the pit and you forget about, you know, the broken down parts and all that kind of thing. You just become to love it like your own. I have to say, it's I love it. It's been just a wonderful place for me. I've thrived here.
Yeah. And do you get back to Ireland much?
I do, as much as I can. And so I'm lucky like that as well. When my mother was sick, I went a lot. I went probably 10 times in 2 years. And, but I mean, that was just when she was sick and that. But and mostly I would say that I go once a year maybe, or more if I'm lucky,
yeah.
If I'm rich in my pocket.
Yeah.
But once a year, it gets a bit more expensive, of course, you know, when you have a husband and two kids, because it's a long way to go.
Yeah. You, when you first came, obviously, as you say, you were a lot younger and you came kind of on spec.
I didn't even have lived to Shannon from Valencia. My parents were in Switzerland at the time. They were off. My sister was living in Switzerland, so they had gone for the month. And I had no lift to Shannon. I'm thinking, how am I going to get to Shannon? I had to hitch. Everybody in Ireland hitched then. It was like, just hitch a ride. That's what they did. And so I was up at the top of the village and I had a small suitcase. I only had a small little bag. I think I had sent a bigger bag the week before with someone that was living in Limerick or something like that. But that's small. And then Paddy Daly stopped. He's a farmer from up the road. And he said, where are you going? I said, I'm going to America, Paddy. Well, he said, I'll take you as far as Killoughlin. And so that was like, you know, 30 miles up the road. And so that was the start. That was my first lift. And then I, you know, managed to get to Shannon anyway after that.
That's great.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah. Worked out fine. But I'm not sure how I got onto that subject.
Well, I was going to ask you how much, I mean, obviously you came with $500,
yeah,
and a small suitcase.
Yeah,
but how much of Ireland do you think you've taken to America with you?
Oh, I think I brought it all. I mean, I must be somewhat Americanized after living here for 25 years plus, you know, but I think I brought it all in my heart.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand the money very well now. I can rock all the phones. I've got the email and all that racket. That doesn't hold me back, but I still have the Grand Macri for Ireland, you know, I'd never lose that. Sure, I was born with it.
In terms of your home here with your own family, do you feel that there is much of your Irish background manifest in your own home, like in your cooking or in how they bring up your children or any traditions in the house?
Well, I suppose about the religion from home. My mother was, I wouldn't say devout Catholic, but she did bring us up in the Catholic tradition, as everybody was brought up in Ireland at the time. And so, and then having been educated by the nuns, the Presentation nuns, I never quite lost that. So, for instance, I do have my kids in the Catholic school here, and I'm proud of those Catholic traditions. You know, I wouldn't say I'm like overtly Catholic or anything like that, but I do like to go to Mass with my family. It makes me feel good. I have to bribe them sometimes, of course. But apart from that, you know, we do have some Irish in our family. We like to, when we bless ourselves, we bless ourselves in Irish, you know, before grace or something like that. I have that little tradition with the family. There's a few words that are in our everyday, like Bob Oak. My youngest son is 11, but when we're screaming at him around the house, it's Bob Oak, you know, get the dishwasher unloaded or something like that. And that's the Irish word for baby, although he doesn't want that shouted at him when he's playing basketball games and stuff like that. You know, nobody knows what it means. I suppose family really is a very big thing in Ireland. And I have to say that it's everything for me here. Family, my lovely husband and my two kids and our extended family are just so important to me. It's everything.
You mentioned that your father comes out to see you sometimes.
Oh yeah, he comes all the time. Well, not all the time, but he just went back on Valentine's Day, February 14th there. He was here for 3 months.
Oh, okay.
And so that was nice, yeah. He has special extended papers as well because he's here so much, you know. Mm-hmm. And so we go to Helena for that and biometric screening and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But he likes to keep that current and then that works out very well for him. And he's older now, he's 77, but he has fantastic health and he likes to travel and we love to have him, we love to see him. It's nice for my boys, you know, when you go to Ireland you have about 2 weeks to get everything fitted in, and how can anybody know their grandparents on 2 weeks international travel? You can't. The only way you know them is by sitting around the fire and drinking tea, and you have to have a longer time for that.
Yeah, it's true.
What else from Ireland did I bring with me? My accent. That'll never leave. Although people are always fascinated by, some people seem to lose their accents very easily. But for somehow or other, I've never lost mine. I don't think I will now.
No, 25 years.
I don't think I, somehow or other it's just stuck and that's it, you know.
You mentioned a couple of things that you have from your family in Ireland. Would you show them to us?
Oh, I'd love to. I'll show you the teapot.
Do.
This is a very old teapot. This teapot is, I think, sometime from around the 1880s. My father's great-grand-aunt was married to a kernman out in Waterville in County Kerry, and her husband died. So there was a second brother in the house, and he was going to take a new wife. And so when the new wife comes in, she kind of takes possession of everything in the house. So my father's great-grand-aunt had to go to the house and steal out her dowry things. And this is one of the things that she stole back out of the house. And I know the house. It's so funny because my parents have showed me the house. I mean, it's a newer house now built behind the ruins of the older house where the teapot was stolen out of. But sometimes when we're in a nostalgic mood, we'll drive out there and we'll say, there's the house now that we that the great-grand-aunt, she was Auntie Joan, she was called, stole the teapot out of. It was her own teapot anyway, but she had to steal it back out. So they gave it to me as a gift. I thought it was lovely. And I actually, it's got a little chip out of it, but I don't mind that. And a tiny bit of the paint is missing because we wrapped it in newspaper when I carried it to America. And there was a bit of scotch tape on the newspaper and didn't take a tiny bit of the paint off here. But you'd never notice it sitting up in the cabinet. And I do love the story of the teapot.
It's a great story.
It's a great story, isn't it? And then I brought my doll.
See the doll? This is Alice. She's missing a few fingers.
And I think she's had an eye transplant, but she's mostly intact. And I got her when I was 2. It was a big thing to get a doll then.
Yeah.
This was really, one of my few toys, actually, as a child. You know, we had playhouses and old cubbies in the back gardens and stuff like that. But we didn't get, you know, Legos. They were never even invented then, I'm sure. And we had a limited budget, you know, you can imagine.
Yeah.
And so I just loved Alice. And my parents gave it to me when I was two. And I think I must have been, they must have been reading Alice in Wonderland to me at the time or something like that. But she got the name Alice and she travelled internationally and she rests here now in Butte, Montana.
And did you make, did the clothes come with her?
My mother made those, aren't they lovely? I'm not talented like that at all.
Yeah.
I learned crochet, but I forgot. I'm sorry. I'm a good cook, but I'm no good for baby's clothes or anything like that.
So your mother handmade that?
My mother handmade the little shawl and the little dress to match. And that really is quite old. I don't know how old the clothing is. I'm sure it wasn't the original. She probably came naked, I'm sure. All the dolls did then with that little plastic thing. Isn't she lovely though?
She's gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. And so she sits up in my closet, and we have a little chat down again. About how great her. It looks like she's got some kind of an astigmatism in her eye, but I'm not going to take her to the eye surgeon or anything like that. She's good to go.
Were your parents Irish speakers?
Not by birth. There was a tradition of Irish speaking in Ballinskellig, which is close to us, and that's a Gaeltacht area. But there is no tradition of Irish speaking on the island. However, they could both speak Irish, but we didn't speak it in the home.
Mm-hmm.
My father actually is quite a linguist. He speaks Irish, French, Spanish, and some Dutch.
Because of the business?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then he used to do some scuba diving for the French trawlers. There was a lot of fishing, you know, French trawlers and Spanish trawlers coming into Valencia and the coast there off the coast of Southwest Kerry, and he used to do some contract work for them, and so he was, you know, easy to pick up the language and that he liked that.
He had an ear for it.
He had an ear for it, exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was there music in the home? Were your parents
music? My father played a piano accordion, of all things, and he loved to do that. But and then he played the guitar later on. I had piano lessons as a child, but I used to hate them. Oh, my God, what a passion.
Yeah.
I used to go to Mrs. Dewan. She must have had the patience of Job because I just did not want to be there. And so I did go. I used to try duck practice and all that kind of thing as well. And I think I did it for about 4 years.
Yeah.
And so I can't play the piano or anything now. I'm really sorry I can't. I'd love to be able to do it. But my parents' intentions were honourable, but I stymied that one.
Yeah, yeah.
No music in the home, though, really. Like, no tradition of fiddle playing or anything like that. I do have my boys learning the violin now, though. They hate it, too.
It's a fine family tradition. In Valencia, were there Paddy's Day celebrations?
Yes, actually. We had a pipe band in Valencia, which is kind of unusual. And on St. Patrick's Day, we always had Mass, that was a tradition, and the choir always sang Hail, Glorious St. Patrick. And we would go out the back lane and get shamrock, you know, it would be growing, you know, just on the path and that. And we'd clip it onto our coat and go to Mass. And then after Mass, the band would parade down the village and play their bagpipe tunes, and we'd all follow them around, you know, just kids.
Yeah.
It was fun. That was it, though.
Were there...
Nothing like here, you know, nothing like the extravaganza of here.
Straw boys on the island?
There weren't straw boys, we called them wren boys.
Yeah, wren boys.
And the wren boys was a big thing for us, and growing up it was a big thing for us. Even in my teenage years, we used to all dress up on St. Stephen's Day and face masks, and then other people would have musical instruments and they'd be playing, and we'd go on the back of tractors to all the houses around, and then we'd go out to the mainland, the pubs and that, and play. And we generally did it for a fundraiser for our, we had a local hospital, which was kind of a little retirement home / hospital, and we generally gave the money to that, you know. It was a good fundraiser for that.
So you'd go from house to house, or
house to bar. Or we'd kind of, there were some houses we would always hit, kind of people that were kind of isolated, that were older people living their own, that liked the music and that kind of thing, you know. But a lot was in the villages. Then in the villages, it's easy to walk up and down because houses are together. But then we needed a tractor to go out for the back island and to go onto the mainland. So we'd be all hiked up to the back of the tractor and the trailer, and just off we'd go, be gone for the day.
What kind of costumes would you wear?
Oh, just old raggy old things, whatever you'd have, you know. Nothing like bought. You'd make up stuff. whatever, you know, you'd have in the attic or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. And so you'd collect money as you would
we
go.
Collect money as we'd go. And then it was always like a good fundraiser because there was always like about 25 of us maybe, you know, that kind of, that's a good gang. And, you know, varying ages from about 11 to 25 maybe, I don't know. But I remember it as a fun time always because we really did enjoy it. And then we liked it. So I would have done like in my teenage years, maybe, and this is before I came to America, you know. Yeah. And I'm not sure if they have that tradition there anymore now. Actually, I don't think they do because I was home last St. Stephen's Day and I don't remember any of that.
Yeah, it's definitely dying out.
Dying out, yeah.
How about patterns or stations?
We had the stations still in Valencia. We have station masses still. And they are when certain townlands, the people that live in the certain townlands, they take it in turns to have a mass in the house, and we have that still, you know, every season. It's not in the summertime; it's like in the fall or in the spring or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's still a tradition that's kept going on the island. And so, if you're in this townland and your neighbor's having the mass, you'll go and have the mass in his house. And then next year might be your turn or something like that, and you'll invite them. And then they generally have a party, you know, depending on the nature of the occupant of the house, of course, you know.
Yeah.
And they have everybody over for drinks and food and stuff like that, and entertainment. The regattas. The regattas are great fun. In South Kerry, the regatta season starts in June and it runs through around the 8th of September. And the Valencia regatta is on August Bank Holiday Monday, and it's always a great time. There is a tradition of same boat racing in South West Kerry.
Same
boat, S-E-I-N-E. And they're long wooden built boats with men that row on them. Not like low flat boats that you think of like on the rivers in England, you know, those, not those low scull boats, they're higher up boats. And it's two men to an oar and a cox. And they have all different levels of same boat racing for the younger kids going up to the adult males. And the girls also row. And so the regattas then are just in Sneem, Cardaniel, Waterville, Valencia, Port McGee, Carsevine, over the water, which is over the water from Carsevine. They have their own regatta. They have the over the water regatta. And then there's one in up around Rospe on the beaches as well. And also one in Kellanafirsty, which is going up towards Killarney, up that area. And so the summer long, everybody goes to the regattas and what team is hot this year, you know, are Kellanafirsty going to do it, or will the Valencia team do it, or who's going, it's great excitement. And we all kind of wander around to the regatta. They're generally on a Sunday afternoon, it's kind of a kind of an off time, and so everybody generally can attend, and they're great fun.
And do they have like street vendors? And
they do, yeah, they have, you know, tinkers with wagons, with three-card tricks and chair planes and plastic stuff from China, you know, on sale, lots of it.
Yeah.
And sometimes they've got crafts people there, and chippers, of course, are always there. And I've seen cotton candy, I think, more recently, but that was not there when I was a child, for sure.
Yeah.
And it's just a busy time. Everybody's out, and, you know, you'll see grandmothers there and grandkids, and all the different generations come to the regattas because it's the tradition of South Kerry in the summertime. And then you always meet people from who live away that come home for the regattas.
Yeah.
It's a great time to hook up with the old friends.
And the one in Valencia is the August Bank Holiday.
That's the August Bank Holiday, and that really is the biggest regatta of the regatta season. And I'm not sure how much of that is linked to the fact that the August Bank Holiday weekend is probably the, you know, the highlight long weekend of the summer, or if it is just the great tradition of having a good time always and people always want to come. I'm not really sure why that is, but it's definitely the busiest regatta of them all. And then it's nicely located because we have the harbour and we have a big promenade and we have the village, and the geographical location is very good. You can see, sometimes in some of the regattas, you can't see all the race because they go down the river or they go around a headland or something, depending on the, you know, the topography of the area.
Yeah.
But in Valencia, you can see it all because it rows down to Ringlass, rows back and over to Begnas. And if you're there on the harbour, you can see it all.
See,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have prizes, you know, cups and things like that that they give out for the different positions that people that win and that.
So when you did you grow up in a like in a village area, or were you out by the sea?
Well, I grew up in the cable station. Of course, that's
course,
where the and that development of 23 houses was right there, sitting majestically by the water's front.
And were they all occupied?
They were not all occupied when I was in my teenage years, because the station had closed down then. When I was a young girl, they were mostly all occupied, yes. Because, you know, when did I say it closed? 65 officially, but I think it had been scaling back on operations for a couple of years prior to that, and people left, they had no jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so a few people stayed, but not there were not that many people living in that development at all. Mostly they became holiday homes for people that could come from, you know, who could afford them, yeah.
And in that locality, were there holy wells or anything like that?
Well, there was holy wells. There, St. Brendan's Well is back island. And that is, the tradition is that when St. Brendan was going to America, there was somebody in a emergency situation on the island, back island there, and he heard the screaming, and he came ashore in his navogue, and he came to whatever. I don't remember what the situation was for the emergency, whether it was a birth thing that went wrong or whatever. Anyway, he came ashore, and he needed water, and there was no water back there in the bogs, although there must have been plenty if it was the bogs. But he put his hand down, and a well sprung up, apparently. And that's the St. Brendan's Well, and that is a holy well, and people visit it all the time.
Still, do you think?
Absolutely, yeah. And so we have some standing stones then on the island from, you know, prehistoric times, but the holy well, the standing stones, and then we also have the slate quarry, which it was turned into a grotto, and that was a slate quarry which housed the roofs of Parliament in Westminster in London, and I think the Sydney Opera House was slated in Valentia slate at one stage. It was a very famous slate, and that's still in operation, but smaller than it was, of course.
Yeah.
And that's out of the mountain, out of the Yaucon Mountain. They mine the slate out of there.
The environment of Valentia is so particular. And then to have come to Butte, Montana, which has its own very particular environment. How would you describe your relationship with the environment here?
I don't really know. I hope it's good. I'm not exactly sure where you're going with that question.
Do you do much work outdoors, or do you spend much time outdoors in terms of sporting?
Oh, I do. Well, in the winter we ski, and in the summer it's beautiful. Well, the great thing about Butte is it's always so lovely with the sunshine, no matter what. Even if it is 25 below, it's blue skies. So that's really nice for an Irish person who's used to a lot of rain, you know.
Yeah.
And especially when you're from an island off the southwest coast. I mean, I think we get 150 inches of rain a year. It feels like that in Valentia anyway. So I do love the blue skies of Butte and the fact that you can get out no matter what. So as a family, we do ski in the wintertime. In the summer, my husband plays a lot of golf. I don't think I have the time for it. But I'm always out about, you know, gardening or walking, or we have the fabulous East Ridge up there, and I'm always up there hiking in the summertime. It's beautiful. Lots of wildlife and that.
Yeah.
But I hope environmentally I fit into it. I try to recycle.
I just think, I guess from my own experience as well, that it's so different, you know, weather-wise and
yes.
In terms of the landscape.
Oh,
and,
yes.
You know, you mentioned you've got the little quarry in Valentia,
yeah.
And then you've got this huge pit.
Oh, right,
Pit,
yeah.
Example,
oh, there's no comparison. And the quarry, when you're up at the quarry in Valentia, you look out and you see Dingle Bay, and you can see the Blascuts off in the distance, and it's just glorious, you know. And when you stand at the viewing stand at the pit, it's quite different, you know. When you look in, it's not what you would call a geographical feast or anything. However, I work at the hospital here, you know,
yeah.
And we've got these fabulous stairwells that have beautiful big windows in it. And when I'm going out the stairwells, there's a certain time of the day when the sun catches the steps of the pit, and they're glorious. They shine so beautifully. And I look out and I see them and I think, how glorious the pit looks. And it reminds me of the pyramids. I went to Egypt once to see the pyramids, you know, and I think they're like the pyramids of Butte. And they look fabulous to me now. So really, beauty does lie in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah.
You know, it is very different to Valentia Island, and you know, no ocean or anything like that. And I do miss all that, but I've certainly come to love it.
Yeah. Tell us just a little bit about your work in the hospital.
Oh, I'm a clinical pharmacist at St. James Healthcare, and so I look at people's labs and I dose their medicine according to their height, weight, age, kidney function, different labs that are pertinent to them. And so all the orders that are processed on patients in the hospital are processed through the pharmacy. The doctors write them and we process them and analyze them and make them right for nursing.
And what's the community of the hospital like?
Well, it's a very busy hospital. It's the only hospital for this area. We've got one down in Missoula and one over in Bozeman, but we serve quite a few counties here: Silver Bow, Beaverhead, you know, Madison County, all that area down the Ruby Valley. We get patients coming up from all that area, and it's quite busy, really. We have a trauma center, and we have surgical suites, four surgical suites. Busy outpatient pharmacy as well, and then we have separate doctor's offices off to the side in another section of the hospital as well. So it's a very busy job. I love it though. And then I also work for the University of Montana, and I take students from the pharmacy program there, and they come and they spend time with me observing the job and seeing what it's like. When they're almost ready to graduate, they come and spend 2 months at a time with me and work with me and see what it's like in hospital pharmacy, because it's quite different to being in school, as you can imagine.
Sure.
I forgot to tell you about going to the University of Montana. Most important.
Oh, did you attend?
I went there for 7 years.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
Well, you better tell us about that.
Oh, my God. when I was here in Butte, you know, I was waitressing. And I thought, God, I got to get out of this line of work. You know, I'd done it in San Francisco, was fine, but I'm thinking, I need to get something else for my future. And so I said to my husband, well, he wasn't my husband at the time, but I'm thinking of going back to school. He said, that's a great idea. I'll support you every way I can. And so then I said, I'm going to go back to pharmacy school. And so then I went down to the University of Montana, and I met a girl there that the family knew very well. She was a good friend of theirs.
In Missoula?
In Missoula, yeah. Laurie Moran was her name. She was an associate dean. And Dean of Students, I think is her title. And so I said, I'm from Ireland, and I did this course, assistance course, and I want to go do pharmacy now in America. Well, she said, you'll have to start at English 101. And that's not going to do you any good here. And so these are the steps you'll have to do. You'll have to go and get all your prerequisites, first of all, and then that'll take you at least 2 years, and then you'll have to apply to the pharmacy school, and you'll have to have excellent grades, or you won't be able to get in. And so then I went to Montana Tech for 2 years and did all the basics, the English 101 and the algebra and the calculus and everything else.
And breastfeeding.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Lovely. How are you?
Good, yourself.
We're just finishing up here.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, that's right. This is Patrick.
Hi,
Patrick. How are you?
And this is Burr Sweeney.
Oh, you just paused it. Sorry.
I did.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Okay. Great.
Well, we better just finish up that
we
you
will.
Part. So, anyway, you can tidy this up when you get a chance. So, after 2 years at Montana Tech, I transferred down to the pharmacy program in Missoula, and we moved down there. My husband and I was married by then. I got married when I was in tech, and we were at school for. Seemed like forever in Missoula at the pharmacy program. I had two kids while I was there as well. Our two sons were born in Missoula, and I graduated in 2000 with my PharmD degree.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It was a struggle.
Sure it was.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Anyway, I did it.
My last question is one we get some very interesting responses to, and it's not one that I've had the chance yet to put to somebody who has come directly from Ireland. And that is, if you were to write the history of the Irish of Montana from your perspective, what do you think should be included in that history?
The history of the Irish that came to Montana, the people that came, you know, with their bags.
Well, but also your own experience. I mean, you're as much part of the story of the Irish of Montana as anybody else.
Well, the people that came long ago were fabulous people. You can't compare the likes of me to them. You know, they had nothing. and they came all the way out here and worked hard and had their families and great success stories. I mean, Butte is their success story, really. And everywhere else that they went in America. I mean, I don't think I could be classed in the same class as those. I mean, I came on TWA and I had $500. That was like a millionaire by comparison to most of those people, you know. And then a lot of those people had kind of problems with discrimination and things like that, you know. I've heard those stories, no Irish need apply and all that. Mm. Sure, I've had red carpets rolled out for me right, left and centre. And so America has been very good to the Irish, I think, really. Whether you're saying that generation, that they worked hard for it, but I mean... they got the rewards, or at least the next generation or the generation after that did. My life's been fabulous with my American experience, you know. It's only getting better and better every year.
Yeah.
So I've thrived here. I think I probably would have thrived in Ireland as well, but that's just how it played out for me, you know. That when I left, a lot of people were coming to America. That was a wave then.
Yeah.
It was not unusual. Maybe if I'd been born in a different time in Ireland, I would have stayed, or maybe I would have gone to England. I mean, in the 50s, I think they went to England en masse, you know. So it was America for me, and that's how it played out.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank
today.
You. It was lovely.
Thank
it was
you.
Lovely. Yeah. I just enjoyed it.